Good morning. This is John Richardson speaking with you from Toronto, Canada. Today is Monday, March the 11th, 2024. And I am once again joined by Karen Alpert in Australia and Laura Snyder in Paris. And we are continuing our discussion of the SEAT Working Paper series. Today is Working Paper number 10. And the specific topic today is extraterritorial taxation violating human rights. Provocative title, a great title, and I think an interesting discussion coming up. So, how are you today, or rather this evening, Karen?
Yeah, great.
So, thanks, John. Laura, what's happening in Paris?
Doing great. Looking forward to spring.
Looking forward to spring. Okay. All right. Karen, you want to lead us through this?
Sure. So we're talking about human rights. There are some international agreements about human rights, aren't there, Laura?
There are several, Karen.
Yes, and the U.S. signed a few of them too, didn't they?
Signed and ratified even.
Wow. So maybe you could start by summarizing for us what the U.S. has signed up to what rights the U.S. has signed up to protect, and then we can talk about how they're not protecting them.
Okay. I think when you talk about the United States, human rights in the context of the United States, probably someone who thinks they know something are going to immediately say, oh, well, human rights are irrelevant in the context of the United States because the United States has made it clear that they're not going to enforce domestically any rights signed that they've signed up to in one of these international agreements. Basically, Americans have constitutional rights. They don't have human rights. And while that's true, I think that a conversation about human rights and what's happening in these international human rights documents and how the United States is violating them is important in our context for two reasons. The first one is it demonstrates when you talk about how the United States violates different human rights, you're talking about how then our current system is immoral. These are the aspects in which you can say the current system is immoral. And it also is important in a conversation of when you talk about violating equal protection rights. And there are elements of that discussion. For example, when you're applying strict scrutiny and you say, well, the United States, can't discriminate on the grounds of nationality in the absence of having a compelling reason to do so. Well, if the actions that you're talking about violate multiple human rights, it's kind of difficult to argue that there's a compelling reason to do it. And if you're applying the rational basis standard under equal protection, then you're meant to show that the United States only needs to show it has a legitimate interest. Well, I don't know that the United States also has a legitimate interest in multiple human rights violations. So I think it's important to establish that context right at the beginning. You cannot simply discount the violations of these human rights, because the United States doesn't enforce human rights. Well, it's true it doesn't, but that doesn't mean that what we're talking about is irrelevant. It's highly relevant. So the rights that are discussed in our paper number 10, and I think you could argue there's other rights, but the ones that I've written about in paper number 10, and we actually originally wrote about this, Karen, you might remember, in the paper that we prepared for the accounting conference. That's right. Where we first published this material. Mm-hmm. So the rights that we're talking about are the right to leave one's country, various rights in relation to work, equality and dignity and rights, the arbitrary deprivation of nationality, and the right to self-determination. Those are the rights that we're talking about.
Okay. So, but the United States lets you walk out the door, take your passport and go move to another country. So how can you say that the United States is violating the right to leave one's country?
Well, physically, you can leave. for sure. There's no bars at the border. At least there's no physical bars at the border, but there are physical bars. And so what happens when you leave the United States to live in another place is what you find is you are unable to save for retirement the way other people can. You can't have a small business the way other people can. You can't invest the way other people can. You can't own your home the way other people can. You can't have bank accounts the way other people can. You can't have participate in community service the way other people can. There are certain jobs you can't have that other people can have. So you can't fully live in the place where you are. You have all of these multiple constraints on your life. And that's where these rules prevent you from leaving your country.
Mm-hmm.
John might have some things to add about that. I don't know.
Yeah, John, would you like to
try? You know, there's this great product that's sold for dog owners called an invisible fence. And it's some kind of electromagnetic field. You just kind of set, you know, how far the dog can go before they get a shock. And, you know, really can't get past that barrier. And I think that a very simple way to view this would be that American citizens are a little bit like dogs subject to the invisible fence. Yeah, I mean, they can go in the backyard, they can take a vacation to another country. But if they go so far as to try to integrate into the financial system, or they become a tax resident of another country, or they have a non-U.S. insurance policy, mutual fund, small business, etc., they will feel the shock of the invisible fence instantly. So I think there's no question about it. I think that the larger context of it is that you know, until people have experienced this, that they simply don't believe it.
Yeah. Even people who are experiencing it for the first time don't believe it.
That's true. They imagine their feet. It's an imagined shock. No, this really can't be true.
I think that that's a really good analogy, but it's hard to accept that you don't have that freedom. To mentally, psychologically accept that. I think for people who are raised to believe that they're free, they're, you know, they're from the land of the free, to actually be confronted with fact demonstrating they are not, it's very difficult to wrap your head around.
That's a fascinating point that you make. And yeah, it's of course absolutely correct. And this is why I think that, you know, a lot of people sort of, you know, they don't see the total picture. They think, well, you know, this one disability imposed on me is just sort of an aberration and everything else is okay. But it's not. I mean, it's all a very specific example of the basic system that the United States wants to punish any American citizen that has foreign income streams, foreign assets, wants to establish tax residence outside the United States, etc. And I think that, why is this so difficult? Well, you know, you grow up in the United States and, you know, you say the Pledge of Allegiance every morning, one nation, indivisible, whatever it is, with freedom and justice for all or something. And, you know, so people don't imagine these things are possible as an American citizen.
Yeah,
absolutely. So, yeah, then the response that you get from a lot of people that hear all these things, oh, well, it's so hard to be an American citizen living outside the United States. One of the first responses you'll hear is, well, why stay an American citizen? Why don't you just renounce?
Well, that's one of the other rights that, well, we've already talked about how American citizenship is a constitutional right. We talked about that in a prior podcast and also in a prior paper. So your right to citizenship is both a constitutional right and a human right. So there are multiple instruments that declare that you are, you know, free from the arbitrary deprivation of nationality. And included in that is the right to return to one's country. Those are interlocking rights. And, you know, we've talked about in the past how, you know, what you have, the situation today is you have a series of laws and regulations that make it very, very difficult to keep your citizenship when you live outside the United States. So that those laws and regulations are causing the arbitrary deprivation of citizenship or of nationality. And with that comes, once you lose your citizenship of a place, you no longer have the right to return to that place. So you automatically lost that additional human right, the right to return.
You know, it's
that. Go ahead, John.
You know, I wonder, you know, this sort of reflexive response. Well, you know, renounce your citizenship then. I mean, at a minimum, it seems to me that the people who say that, they don't even understand what citizenship is. They don't understand why it's important, et cetera. I mean, I think they're equating it with sort of a club membership or something, or, you know, or perhaps residence. But they clearly have no understanding of what this is. But Laura, you know, you said something twice now that I think is very, very interesting, is the difference between a human right and a U.S. constitutional right. And I think you said that Americans have constitutional rights, but not so much human rights. Is that accurate?
Legally, yes. Legally speaking, that's right.
Yeah. Would you expand on that a little bit? I think that's a really fascinating concept.
Well, I think you actually know more about this element than I do, John. But essentially, if you try and argue a human right before a U.S. court and try to, you know, enforce a right that exists only under human rights, an international, you know, treaty or human rights instrument, and not under the U.S. Constitution, you're basically going to lose. U.S. courts won't enforce them. They're not, the rights in these human rights instruments are not considered enforceable in U.S. courts. Even though
the U.S. has signed all these treaties, they're not enforcing them.
Correct. They can be used as moral persuasion, but you must have some other foundation in addition to that.
Isn't it, and part of it as well, that the way the limitation, okay, if I'm not mistaken, I think the way this plays out is that the human right aspect of it, the international human right aspect of it, is limited by the conception of the U.S. constitutional right given, right? So in other words, if an international human right has a more expansive definition, then the way it is understood in the U.S. Constitution, the U.S. courts will limit it to the understanding or the extent of the right under the Constitution, irrespective of the broader international human right, correct?
Yes. And then there will be rights that are human rights that won't be anywhere in the Constitution.
What would be some examples of that?
Well, the right to leave one's country.
All right. Now, yeah, well, let's pause on that, because I think you're absolutely right on that. And if we look at the U.S. Constitution, I don't believe there is any constitutional right at all to leave the country.
No, I think right? There's even one or two lower federal court decisions that imply that there is not, if I recall correctly.
I think that's right. And I think that to some extent, the problem here is that the U.S. has a very old, antiquated constitution that, you know, simply is completely out of sync with the modern world. Of which, you know, the recent abortion decisions, for example, would reflect that, I think. You know, and if you don't want to look at a judicial decision, you look at the text of more modern constitutions that might actually give a constitutional right to both leave and enter the country for citizens. And none of this really exists in the U.S. Constitution. So I don't know. I mean, is part of the problem here that the U.S. simply does not have a modern constitution that blends well with the world that we live in today and the human rights documents that are out there today? Does that make sense?
Definitely. I would say at the time our constitution was adopted, I don't think it probably would have occurred to anyone that a right to leave the United States needed to be constitutionalized. And plus, you know, people weren't leaving so much, at least that was the perception. They were coming. Well, I guess people probably were leaving and leaving quite a bit, but they were leaving freely. And I don't know, again, that anybody needed, even would have occurred to them, or even they would have taken seriously any suggestion that you needed to constitutionalize such a right. And also, we've talked about this, I believe we have, about how the concept of citizenship has changed over, you know, in over the centuries. And at the time that the U.S. Constitution was adopted, you still had the idea of citizenship more as subjectship than, you know, some sort of personal right. It was more, you know, you were a subject of your nation, and as a subject slash citizen, you had obligations. You did not have rights. And so it's, you know, a good, what, 150, 200 years after the adoption of the Constitution that we've had this dramatic evolution in the concept of citizenship to a nexus of rights rather than a nexus of obligation. But the short answer to your question is, John, yes, definitely the Constitution is not fit for purpose. If and when we have a new Constitution, whether we will adequately address these questions is remains to be seen.
Well, I think it's also interesting to observe, you know, recognizing that all these things are the product of their times. But the U.S. Constitution is not and was never intended to be a guarantee of individual rights.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, things like the 14th Amendment, you know, come later. They're very vague. And, you know, and Karen made this point in one of our earlier podcasts, which, you know, sadly is correct, that the only real progress in the area of human rights in the United States really comes from the courts, I think, doesn't it?
I think that's true.
Well, the Bill of Rights, you know, there was a discussion at the time the Constitution was adopted, you know, do we have a Bill of Rights? It was not part of the, you know, the original document, their amendment. But the reason why, very generally speaking, the reason why these rights are considered, it is important to memorialize these rights in a document like a Constitution, like a human rights treaty, is because the danger is that legislatures are the very bodies that will violate these rights. And that is, it is the courts, it is generally the courts that will come and strike down laws, so the acts of the legislature, because they violate these rights. It's not so much the legislatures themselves that are, you know, thinking, oh, you know, we can't do this because it'll violate a right. The attitude is more like, sue us. We'll do this if we want to, and if you don't like it, sue us. Maybe you win, maybe you won't, and in the meantime, our law will be in effect.
Well, yeah, I think the key point here is that the purpose of individual constitutional rights is to protect people generally from the abuses of government, but more specifically, to protect minority groups, you know, from sort of mob majority rule, right?
Manifested by the legislature. But yes, John, that's right. Yeah.
You know, and if we look at, I think we talked about this last time, you know, so the Euphorian decision that essentially constitutionalized citizenship is 67. And for a very lengthy period after that decision, the U.S. government continued to violate the rights of its citizens. I mean, it took a full 20 years for an amendment to the Immigration and Nationality Act in 1986, which acknowledged what the Supreme Court had said on the matter, right? So this is, you know, individual rights are a really big deal, a huge deal. And, you know, my own sort of, you know, I went to law school in Canada before Canada had a charter of rights with individual constitutional rights. And at that time, the only constitutional issue in Canadian constitutional, I'm not kidding, the only issue was which government had the right, had the jurisdiction to violate your rights. That was the only issue. There was no concept of individual rights at all. And in 1982, when was actually the first Trudeau government, managed to get the Canadian Charter of Rights into the Constitution. What you know, in hindsight, I find amazing now is that a lot of people in Canada objected to the idea of individuals having rights. And a certain group actually said, well, that for Canadians to have rights would make them more like Americans, which I think is really an acknowledgement of the myth of America and not the reality. Because in the modern world, I suspect that there are countries, you know, where there are fewer rights than in America. But I think objectively, one would have to agree that the United States of America is no leader in human rights whatsoever. And if anything, is, I think, more of a serial human rights violator, right? As Americans abroad find out.
I think anybody who is in good faith would have to agree with that.
Yeah. So you talk about the right to leave a country and return, but there are other rights that you've mentioned in this paper. So maybe we move on to the rights around working. Yeah, you have a right to work, you know, in whatever profession you choose.
Well, the instruments provide for a right to work, the free choice of employment, freedom from discrimination in employment, notably based on national origin, and equal opportunity for promotion and employment, subject to no consideration other than seniority and competence. So those are the rights you see in the human rights instrument. So right to work, free choice of employment, freedom from discrimination in employment, including based on national origin, and equal opportunity for promotion. And so how do you see those rights violated with our current extraterritorial tax system? Well, you see that Americans who have created their own small businesses, it's very difficult to be an American operating a small business outside the United States. So difficult that, you know, you see from our surveys, especially with, well, before even GILTI and the transition tax, the mandatory repatriation tax came along, it was already quite difficult because of, you know, the heavy CFC rule. And then when the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act with transition tax and GILTI, it made it even more difficult to operate a small business. So you see in the surveys we've conducted, people saying, I just can't do it anymore. I have to shut my business down. Or people saying, I'd like to have my own business. But when I look at what's involved with the U.S. tax rules, I realize it's not possible. I just can't do it. So there's one way that our tax system violates the rights to work.
You also find people who have this great business opportunity, but their partners who are not U.S. citizens say, no way, we're not going to bring a U.S. citizen into this business.
Right. You both have entrepreneurial active opportunities are denied to you. Employment opportunities are denied to you because either your partners or your employer do not want to deal with a U.S. citizen. So there you've got, you know, blatant discrimination based on national origin. You've got...
Well, Laura...
Yeah.
Can I ask you this question? I mean, I do agree with you on this, right? But if you were to say to a congressman in the United States, right, or somebody at Treasury, well, look, Americans abroad are being discriminated against. They would say, well, not by us, they're not.
That's true. True if you want to talk about fat too. I mean, in terms of the bank or what the actions that the banks take, that's true. It's the laws that are causing it. You know, they are doing it because of these laws. They're not doing it for any other reason. So it is causing. It is the cause of what's happening. The laws are, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, and the Republicans overseas, you know, brought the first lawsuit against FATCA in the United States, you know, around somewhere between 2012 and 2014. And, you know, they made some of these arguments, but they lost on standing in the sense that they were, you know, they never really had the thing heard on its merits. But one of the points that the judge made, or one of the judges along the way, was precisely that, you know, just that it was the foreign banks that were, you know, causing the problems, not, you know, not the U.S.
But the U.S. is causing problems in CFC rules, etc., because those apply only to Americans who live in other countries. Any non-Americans are left alone if they're outside the U.S. But if you're American and outside the U.S., the U.S. tax system wants money from you, or at least forms which cost you money to have prepared.
Well, and ultimately give them the bullets to shoot you down the road, right? You know, with the retroactive laws like the mandatory repatriation tax, for example.
Mm-hmm. John, this goes back to, you know, what we talked about when we talked about the right to leave one's country. What's happened here is very insidious. It's not obvious and blatant. There are no physical bars at the border. It is all, you know, much more insidious and more difficult to, yes, if you want to stand before a judge who's looking for reasons to deny your claims, he's going to find that reason for sure. And it's what.
Yeah, and then that's, you know, that's a big part of the problem here. It's the, you know, I've come to see this issue as largely, you know, that optical illusion where, you know, that you can see this old woman or the young woman as the same thing back and forth. Yeah, it's very much a difference. It's a difference in perspective. And when Americans abroad talk about these problems with resident Americans, or I think even I would go so far as to say the tax preparation community, they're not talking about the same thing at all. I mean, they may use the same words, but they have a fundamentally different understanding, or in the case of the tax preparation community, lack of understanding of what's going on here.
Well, I think that just to on the rights to work, you know, there's other elements to it, but, you know, people today, you know, there's a lot of talk about how people in the United States don't have access to dignified jobs that allow them to live the type of life they want to lead. And people can have opportunities outside the country. A lot of people would like to leave the country to pursue professional opportunities outside the United States. But I'm sure that there are some that will look, if they understand what the tax implications will be, they'll say, I'm not sure I want to do that. I'm going to stay in the United States. And to the extent that, you know, you make that decision that you say, it's too difficult for me to live and work as an American outside the United States, I've got to stay in this country. That's not exactly freely chosen work in the spirit of these human rights instruments.
Well, absolutely. You know, maybe another way of looking at this is that, I mean, if I were to make what would sound like an outrageous statement to somebody living in the United States who'd never heard this, but I'll make the statement. In the 21st century, U.S. citizenship is a disability. Would you agree with that?
In these contexts, yes, definitely. In an employment context, no doubt. It's not an advantage.
Well, it's certainly not an advantage unless you're living in the U.S.
Well, then none of this matters, you know.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, this may be a little bit extreme, but essentially, you know, we can talk about this as an invisible fence, which is, I think, a simple analogy that the average person could understand. You know, we can talk about this in terms of being more specific. You know, what really are additional burdens on employment, self-determination, you know, et cetera, which I think is a harder concept for people to understand, partly because they're indoctrinated to think that, you know, Americans have all these rights and freedoms, and also because most of them never tried to leave the United States. But if I were to go further and use the phrase fiscal prison, would you say the United States is a fiscal prison?
Yes, we've used that before. We used that terminology before. They're not physical bars at the border, they're fiscal bars at the border. On that point you just made, John, I remember in the survey that we did a few years ago, I remember at least a couple people telling stories about how in their, where they were employed, they were blackmailed because they had not disclosed to their employer that they were U.S. citizens. They purposely hid it. And one of their colleagues knew it and basically were threatening to blackmail them with the employer, you know, to kind of out them to the employer that they were U.S. citizens. So I think that's a real answer to your question, John. Is it an advantage to be a U.S. citizen?
Well, you know, there's this great Clavell book called King Rat, you know, which is, I haven't read it for many, many years, but it's about a Japanese open prison, okay, where these people are just put on this island, basically, and, you know, they set up their own sort of society, but, you know, they really no way of getting off, right? It's, you know, it's an open prison. And, you know, again, maybe harsh language, but maybe that's another analogy, right? That, well, maybe not. I suppose somebody say, well, you're allowed to physically leave the United States. So can it be an open prison? Well, I don't know. It depends. I mean, you know, free to leave, but not free to live when you leave, you know, sort of thing. Not free to live, you know, as you would like when you leave. I mean, there's a lot of interesting analogies here. There's certainly a lot of problems. But I think that I've sort of come to see over the years that great powers, in order to become great powers, they have to generally abuse their citizens, you know, because you need to have them sort of coordinated towards some kind of a collective end here or goal. And, you know, the United States does this in certain ways. Russia has done it in certain ways. Certainly China does it in certain ways. And, you know, you have American citizens when they leave other countries and they sort of, you know, they leave and they erode the tax base of other countries, you know, through these problems. I mean, would it be outrageous to say that one aspect of U.S. citizenship taxation is a way to, you know, continue a certain warfare against the economies of other countries? What do you think?
It certainly is that, for sure. I don't know to what extent it was conceived for that purpose. I think it was conceived for the purpose of just punishing people who have the temerity to live outside the United States. But it certainly has that effect. I mean, it is, as you've said often, John, you know, taxing people who are tax residents of other countries. You're extracting resources from other countries and interfering in the right of self-determination of other countries. That's one of the other human rights violations to discuss just by these laws. You know, you're extracting, someone lives in another country, has their income in another country, uses the resources of another country, and the United States says, well, okay, we have the right both to tax that income, even though it has really nothing to do with the United States other than the fact that the person in question has U.S. citizenship. And also, because these laws affect how a person lives in another country, it affects how they can save for retirement, whether or not, you know, they can have their own business, how they can invest, how they can own their own home. It interferes in the right of self-determination of these other countries because they set up their own laws for how they want their country to work in terms of how they want, what economic benefits they want their residents to have. And how
what economic behaviors they want to incentivize.
There you go. Exactly. Exactly. And so the U.S. law comes and sits on top of that and will disincentivize and penalize what that other country where the person actually lives wants to encourage. And Karen certainly can speak to that in terms of Australian superannuation.
And exactly.
So in other words, you know, the effect of these kinds of laws is to create in other countries a class of people who are more likely to, you know, need social and public assistance in their retirement years, right?
Right.
You know, that's a big problem. That is a really big problem.
Yeah. Yeah. And I, you know, I've talked to Australian residents who had saved up a bunch of money. They were going to give it out as as charitable donations. And it turned out that they had a U.S. tax liability and the U.S. got it. So, you know, it was drained out of Australia. And it's not just theoretical.
Yeah. Oh, there's absolutely no doubt. I mean, you can put it in tax speak by saying the OECD might relate to this, that, well, you know, a U.S. citizenship taxation constitutes base erosion of the tax base of other countries, right?
That's right.
You know, you can put it that way. Nobody will understand. Or you can put it more accurately, which is the U.S. tax system steals from other countries.
Okay, so what other rights did we discuss in this paper, Laura?
We talked about the right to leave one's country, rights to work. We talked about the arbitrary deprivation of nationality and the right to return to one's country. We've just touched on the right of other countries, the right of self-determination. And then there's another right in the paper, equality and dignity and right, which is a little bit abstract. But essentially what this right is that it's the right, yes, to a person to be treated with dignity and have equal rights to other persons. And there's a philosopher named Karst who makes this seem a little less abstract. He describes this as when a person is treated as an inferior, or when they're treated in a manner that differentiates them from others in such a way that they do not belong, they're not quite human, or they're stigmatized. And so he explains this right as freedom from stigma. And so you will see this right, how I describe in the paper how the U.S. extraterritorial tax system violates this right to dignity is that it results in Americans overseas being stigmatized by employers, potential employers, and business and entrepreneurial partners because they don't want to either employ or partner with a U.S. citizen. They're, again, deprived of opportunities for tax advantage retirement savings and other investments. Can't invest in mutual funds. The banks don't, financial planners don't want them as clients. Their families keep their names off of their titles to family assets. So essentially, this is a violation of the right to equality and dignity and rights, of the freedom from stigmatization.
So basically, what you're saying is that the U.S. extraterritorial tax system causes Americans who are overseas to be discriminated against by the people that they are dealing with where they live, because those people don't want to be involved with someone who's going to be reporting back to the U.S. through an FBAR or have to pay tax on a controlled foreign corporation and possibly have business decisions that are based on U.S. taxation rather than local taxation.
Yeah, it singles out and targets Americans for less favorable treatment. And as a result of that, they're stigmatized. Mm-hmm. The laws stigmatize them, and then the people around them stigmatize them.
Okay. Did you want to add something, John?
No, I think that's absolutely right. But as we reach the end of this, you know, if you want, I'd like to get your views on a thought I have about the direction this is going.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Yeah, which is this. So, you know, we see a clear trend in the United States, of which the Moore issue is just one example. We see this in, you know, the Biden Green Books and that. We see a clear trend towards taxation in circumstances that don't constitute an actual realization event, right? In other words, sort of fake income, right? Or, you know, the Biden proposal to, you know, treat the increase in the value of a stock portfolio from year to year as a capital gain taxable now, right? Now, so far, you know, the way the U.S. tax system interacts with the tax systems in other countries, it's been, you know, bad. But can you imagine if, let's say, that Congress passed a law that says that you have to pay capital gains tax both on a deemed realization basis and an actual realization basis, how that will absolutely make it absolutely impossible for American citizens to live outside the United States?
Because so it'll make it possible for American citizens to invest their money outside of the United States.
No, and inside the United States. Because let's look at an example where, you know, say somebody lives in, say, Canada, which, you know, imposes taxation at the point of the actual sale of the securities.
Right, right.
So let's say that you've got a, you know, a stock portfolio of $1 million or something. And the U.S. is busy taxing that every year based on the gain. But because there's a timing difference between that and what was going on in Canada, right? I mean, it's either going to force the person in Canada to sell every year to generate, right. To generate a tax can be used to credit against the U.S. or the result of it is going to be pure double taxation, right?
Right.
So, you know, my point is that, you know, unless this gets changed fairly soon, I think it's going to get a lot worse, you know, because of this, you know, this creating these taxable events when there's no realization. What are your thoughts on that?
Right. No, I think you make a good point.
So what are these other countries going to do? I mean, at some point, I think they're going to have to acknowledge this and stand up to it.
Really? I mean, really? Do you think that they bow down to the United States on so many things? This is probably just nothing to them.
Yeah, well, basically, their reaction is going to be, well, that serves you right for maintaining your U.S. citizenship. Renounce.
I'm not so sure about that. Because if this becomes a clear impediment, you know, in other words, if they start to understand that this is going to increase their welfare bills and stuff like that, if they come to understand these U.S. tax laws create a permanently downwardly mobile class of people in their own country, I don't see how they can ignore this. I mean, the rational thing would be to simply prohibit immigration from the United States and deport U.S. citizens. I mean, that, you know, that would be the rational thing to do. I mean, it seems to me at some point, countries either need to defend their citizens and tax residents or get rid of them. But you cannot essentially continually cede a proportion of your population to the whims of another country.
I would imagine, well, there's probably already a lot of, you know, you kind of imagine what's going on in the heads of leaders of other countries. And, you know, we had the opportunity to kind of have a brush with that. Was it a year and a half ago, John, when we were in D.C. and we...
Oh, yeah. So, oh, goodness.
And, you know, I would imagine to a certain extent, you know, who wants to come up against the United States on an issue like this when we can all be portrayed as just tax evaders or people just not wanting to pay our taxes? And what's our problem? Just pay your taxes. And there's not enough of us for them to really consider it significant enough in their, you know, in their overall, maybe in Canada, because there's so many Americans in Canada or Mexico, but in other countries or the Philippines, maybe, but in other countries, are there enough of a critical mass of Americans?
Yeah, there's not in Australia. There's not enough Americans for it to make that huge of a difference.
I would say, you know, in some ways, if countries did have the reaction that John has said, while it would be painful in the short run, it could be very good in the long run, because then you make this a problem of people in the United States who want to leave, who are confronted with the problem immediately. They cannot leave at all. It's not that they leave and then they discover all these problems. It's that they cannot even get, you know, the initial, you know, right to live or visa that they need to even immigrate, have an initial immigration to another country. And when they're told, well, the reason is because of your laws, then you can see that finally Americans who live in the United States would get interested in this and consider this their problem. Right now, they don't think it's their problem, even though it obviously is their problem.
Right. Okay. It's probably time to wrap this up. We've been going about 45 minutes, I think. So, Laura, do you have any final thoughts?
Just thanks to you and John for the discussion. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Thank you for your great series of papers, Laura. I mean, without those...
Yes, definitely.
Having those discussions.
Yeah, well, this has been a really good discussion. There's a lot of rights out there that the U.S. is violating, and even more when you can start to consider the extraterritorial tax system.
The extraterritorial tax system. Do you think that it would be a good idea to stop extraterritorial American taxation, do you think?
I think.
John, would you believe we created an organization just for that purpose?
You're kidding me. Tell me about that as a closing to this. Where would people learn about that?
SeatNow.org. Stop Extraterritorial American Taxation. SeatNow, S-E-A-T, now.org. You can find out lots of things about what we're doing.
I'll
get a copy of this lovely paper about human rights and extraterritorial taxation, along with all the remaining working papers.
Well, I must check that out immediately, and I would encourage all listeners to check that out, which again is at seatnow.org. Well, Karen, I invite you to wrap this up if we're done.
I think we're done. Well, thank you, John, for hosting the podcast. And thank you, Laura, for the insightful paper.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Okay.